Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and you're listening to Sparks on RadioFax. This week, how the Channel 5 TV bidders plan to cooperate and not bid against each other. Phone freaks hack the cell phone network. The recent shortwave fade out. A review of the Sinclair Zike. The problems of CB abuse. Electronic tags for sheep and sports cars. And how B-Sky B nearly went bust last year. The professor turning engineering courses upside down, and a crop circle competition. That's all in this week's Sparks, 3910 6205 and 12255 on RadioFax is where you'll find us.
On the A train, it's not that far. From the sharks in the penthouse to the rats in the basement. It's not that far.
The Radio 4 Punters programme did a piece about piracy on the CB bands. Here's part of their report.
The DTI, that is to say the Department of Trades and Industry, are doing with my licence fee.
It's one of the main things I've got the CB in for. It's not just to keep me awake at night, as some people say, but it's very important for road checks and road work reports and accidents, if there are any.
Do you find along the way that the information received is interrupted by the nuisance element?
Yes, around major cities like Sheffield, Manchester, Liverpool, they seem to have a larger amount of idiots, as they put it.
What do you think should be done about it?
It should be policed better. The old DTI ought to be going around knocking on a few more doors, I think.
Now there's your hooligan element, look. That's just one instance. The braking channel that most of the mobiles or anybody will use. Well, you've got a mic here in there, you've also got a music player in there. Serving no useful purpose, they're just blocking the channel because they've got nothing else better to do. Mic ears. That's when they are keying the mic, but not holding any conversation of their own. They're just intent on breaking up somebody else's conversation. Well, I mean, that's just a noise. They're just doing that for sheer nuisance value, which to me just makes them mental drawbacks. And unfortunately, they seem to have the best equipment and the stronger signal. And obviously, you know, they are not running a legal system. And this sort of equipment always seems to get into the hands of the morons. And that's what we want finding.
We pay our license fee for a service off of people like, well, and then we get the idiots coming in. They're not paying no licence fees. They're just here just to throw their tuppence worth in obscenities. So, find out the culprits and have them prosecuted.
Good afternoon, I'm Barry Maxwell. I'm the director of the DTI's Radio Investigation Service.
We feel that the system is not getting to the root of the problem, which is the hooligan element in the towns and cities. What can be done about that?
I recognise that there is abuse on CB, but it's not true to say that the RIS is not active on the bands. I would refute that. I don't want to bore you with statistics, but I think I ought to at least give you some. Last year, the RIS had a commitment to undertake about 6,000 inspections of CB, which I think is a pretty fair proportion, given that CB is an important hobby to you, I accept, but a hobby nonetheless. Last year, the RIS prosecuted 116 cases involving CB. Of those 116 cases, 69 of them resulted in forfeiture of equipment, which was either being used illegally or without a licence. And the agency got £23,000 worth of fines and costs from the CBers. So although I'm sure you're going to say to me we could be doing more, I would say to you that we're doing a fair bit already.
Well, I can't agree that that is effective.
The RIS has to work across the whole of the radio spectrum. It's not just a matter of concentrating on CB. And I have to say to you frankly, and I'm not ashamed, because I think any enforcement force has to work by priorities. It's the same for the police, it's the same for the customs, it's the same for anybody else. And our ministers have said that our priorities have got to be to deal with interference which affects safety of life and then affects business radio. And unfortunately, hobby radio comes within that third area of priorities.
Mr. Maxwell may think that it's a hobby, but we know that it is far more important than that. And sometimes it is crucial that we get this information through to the drivers. And we think that more could be done to keep our airways clear of the hooligan element.
10-10 till we do it again.
Valerie Hurst reporting.
And that was from Punters on Radio 4.
Well, that's something the government did say would happen, and certainly keying music down Channel 19 is something I've heard on quite a number of occasions, and they should take that rather more seriously than just a hobby, because certain people could be using 19 in emergencies. So, fair enough, people keying music up and down elsewhere is not such a problem, but on Channel 19, I think it should be given a bit more of priority. I think you can only take free radio so far, and some of the people I've heard on CB are real out-and-out tossers. There's no two ways about it. Old MacDonald, in The Observer, helps keep stock of stolen cars and bikes. Farming has helped provide the solution to a troublesome security problem for both cars and motorcycles, that of identifying a stolen vehicle which has been expertly disguised by thieves, writes Sue Baker. A device used to identify cattle, sheep and other livestock is being adopted as a hidden means of indelibly tagging vehicles. Last week, the motorcycle industry, spurred by the alarming 200 motorcycles stolen every day, more than 30% of which are never recovered, took the lead with an electronic data tag based around a passive transponder developed by the German electronics giant AEG. It can permanently code a vehicle with an identity which cannot be erased, even if the registration, chassis and engine numbers are changed, or if the machine is broken down into its major component parts. Passive transponders are used in farming for stock control. The tiny device, no bigger than the tip of a pencil, is injected into the animal's ear, where it remains permanently and can be read externally using an electromagnetic scanner. Now a choice of two similar devices is being made available to the motor industry, either a tiny cylinder 1 centimetre long or a little tablet like an aspirin. The cylinder is so small that it can be injected anywhere into soft material on a vehicle, such as seat foam or door trim, or even into some softer types of wood. The tablet can be glued almost anywhere on a motorcycle or car. Each transponder has a unique 10-digit code which makes the vehicle identifiable to a scanner for comparison against detailed records held on a computer. A car or motorcycle's life history can thus be read from the unseen device. A thief would have to dismantle every part to look for it, and even so would very possibly not find it. AEG, looking for other applications for the device outside agriculture, offered it to Yamaha motorcycle importers Mitsui at the motorcycle show last November. As a result, it is now fitted to all new Yamahas, and the motorcycle industry, deeply concerned at the way in which theft of bikes is pushing up insurance premiums, has formed a consortium to adopt it as a theft deterrent. Now car manufacturers are considering the implications, spurred by the Home Office having declared 1992 as Car Crime Prevention Year. There may also be scope for the device in home security. For example, a transponder could be injected into the wooden frame of a valuable painting. The transponders can be bought as part of a security kit, which also includes glass etching equipment and registration with the database held on Mitsui's computer. It costs £41.50, including VAT, from any franchise dealer of the big five motorcycle companies, Honda, Suzuki, Kawasaki, Yamaha and BMW. Sue Baker there, writing in The Observer. And a letter here from Cherry Hinton in Cambridge. That's not the name, it's Chris Cortez. And his letter mentions the severe shortwave fade-outs on the 10th of May, caused by a major aurora. I thought you'd like to hear the enclosed tape so you can hear just how bad the shortwave reception was yesterday. You were really unlucky that band conditions were severely down with a very rapid fade on the day chosen for Radio Facts to repeat the excellent Jill Moss programme Caroline into the 90s. Old Jim and all the other Irish and British shortwave operators had no chance with conditions like that. Well, if you were one of the people who missed the repeat of Caroline into the 90s, a 60-minute extended cassette version can be bought from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London, W72LL. And the price is £9.99, which goes to the Ross Revenge Support Group. That's Caroline into the 90s, a 60-minute cassette documentary. Send your order to Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London, W72LL. Read that for Ron and quite a few other people who've also been asking about that. So back to Chris's letter. I use an external wire aerial at this world-famous address, Cherry Hinton, connected to my old-style Big Grundig Yacht Boy radio. Following on, band conditions were really bad in that on the 10th of May. Usually Radio Fax and WNKR would thump in loud and clear. As a Mark I anorak, age 44 and a half, I am very upset and angry at what Peter Moore allowed to happen to Radio Caroline, and at the fact that the station seems to have broken with tradition and thrown in the free radio offshore towel, rather than fight the Illegal Broadcasting Act. Satellite, 28 days and third world offshore are not free radio, and of no interest to supporters of real radio. Well, Peter Moore, just like the rest of us, has been suffering from the recession, and really there's been a lot less cash floating about to keep the thing going, so I'd say let him off the hook a bit. As things start to pick up financially, I think that'll be all the more help to get Radio Caroline back out to sea. Let's hope one day soon Radio Caroline will rediscover her backbone and stomach for the fight, secretly fly out a new radio ship and return to the airwaves from the North Sea. Take care and keep up the good work with Radio Fax. Thanks for that, Chris. And he says, I could give you a long list of reasons why the Broadcasting Act will never be used against Radio Caroline or any other North Sea radio ship. Why don't Richards Butler, that's the solicitors working for them, produce such information in exchange for the £26,000 of Anorak's cash that it's received? Well, that's a very mysterious statement. And continuing on the subject of the solar fade-out, Over and Outer Media Network, presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hope you can hear us. It's been rough listening, hasn't it, according to the answer line.
This is Timothy Williams in Syracuse, New York, USA. Conditions have been pretty atrocious on the short wave. Could just barely get WWCR1, for example, just moments ago on 7435.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Mary Ann Cahill calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Sunday there was absolute total shortwave fade out, except for some sporadic activity in the 41 and 49 meter band. I couldn't even pick up WWV in any of the frequencies. I was wondering if there was any unusual solar activity or what the situation was. Thank you.
Well, from late on Saturday to midday on Monday, high-frequency propagation conditions worldwide range from between poor to useless. Conditions only started to recover on Tuesday, but even then things weren't all that good. Let's go straight over to our propagation specialist, Mike Bird, who's on the line from Melbourne.
Well, the culprit was sunspot region 7154, which had so far only produced a few small M-class flares. Now, on Friday, it started flaring again. During this period, HF communications through the polar regions were virtually useless. Returning to Saturday, the main charged particle cloud from Friday's flare impacted the geomagnetic field at around 1959 UTC, and a storm started immediately. It continued throughout Sunday and started to abate around midday on Monday. Now, during the height of the storm on Sunday, 60 to 80% depressions to the ionosphere were observed, and the Fredericksburg A index reached 116.
You probably know that at any instant there's a maximum usable frequency above which you hear nothing at all on the wireless. But that MUF dropped so much this past weekend that signals on the tropical bands were affected too. During disturbances like this, shortwave signals near the polar regions disappear first, whilst those from the tropical parts of the world are relatively unaffected.
That's right. It spreads from the polar regions into the mid-latitudes, but this time it got into the tropical regions and affected the ionosphere there. We have readings from northern Australia which are very, very depressed. Also, Jonathan, we observed tremendous auroral displays in southern Australia, and also the auroral flutter was unbelievable. It was very fast indeed.
Well, later in the programme I'll try and fit in a recent report about the studies into solar activity that went on around the solar eclipse last year, and also a report about WNKR on 3945, so stay tuned to Sparks on Radio Facts. I'll have another letter now. Let's see what we can find. Yes, from Preston in Lancashire. My name is Peter Robinson, and I'm 25 years old. I've been listening to Radio Facts since the station started and have always enjoyed the programmes. I'm an admin assistant in the civil service, poor you, and was editor of the Radio Review column in the World DX Club newsletter called Contact. The column looked at shortwave programme contents. Well, fortunately, you've got an enjoyable hobby. I enjoy many types of music, especially David Bowie, since I saw him on the tribute to Freddie Mercury on television. Did you see that? Yes, I did. I think he sang with Annie Lennox, didn't he? It was very entertaining. Recently, I saw Hawkwind in concert at the Guildhall in Preston. I went there with my brother, and it was the best concert I've ever been to. Although only a three-piece, they produced an excellent sound. Well, a man after my own heart here. Regular and old hippie listeners will recognise we play a fair bit of Hawkwind here on Sparks. And I'm an old fan of them, being an old hippie in training. Back to Peter Robinson's letter. My interests beside radio are reading, music and herbal remedies. There's an enclosed leaflet about NatraCalm, which I seem to remember was advertised on Radio Caroline at one point, wasn't it? Something very similar, something like that. The free radio service is non-existent here in Preston. There were some stations from Merseyside on medium wave, Radio Atlantis on 1197, and Radio Mersey Waves. However, they've disappeared. Radio Facts puts in some excellent signals, so I listen to you as the only free radio station, besides Radio Dublin International, on 6911, that I can receive with good SINPO ratings. So, in Preston is Peter Robinson. Hello to you.
Astonishing figures are quoted for abuse and fraud on the telephone networks in the United States particularly. Radio 4 had a look at the question.
They can, by dialing a series of codes, access outside dial tone and away they go, calling anywhere they so desire. Once they've broken the codes for any of those systems, they do one of two things. They may publish the information for free on an electronic bulletin board and share it with their computer hacker friends. More often, they are actually selling the codes for profit, and they may sell them for $10, $15 a code, but in turn, the people who have bought them then resell them to anyone from drug dealers to call cell operations to actually organized crime. Anyone who wants to place calls and not be identified or traced.
So how big is this curious illegal world? According to the Secret Service in Washington, telephone theft costs $1.2 billion. In Chicago, the lawyer Bill Cook disputes that figure.
The fraud aspects of it are easily in the $5 billion range.
That's much bigger than any of the figures I read.
Actually, that figure is probably much smaller than the reality of the problem, because the problem is one that's inherently concealed by the victims of the crime.
They don't want it to be known that they've been abused.
From a business point of view, they view it as definitely to their detriment to let the world know that they are vulnerable and have been taken.
One company which is taking ATT to court is Mitsubishi. They are refusing to pay a phone bill for $423,000, £250,000, presented to them by ATT after a hacking raid on their equipment. Ted Pearson's a Washington lawyer representing Mitsubishi.
It's a scandal equivalent to the junk bond scandal and an SNL scandal in this country. You have an innocent victim ending up paying the local exchange company and a long distance company. The long distance companies are getting paid twice. The more fraud that occurs, the more they get paid. The long distance companies in this country right now are insisting that they be paid for the incoming call and the outgoing call, and they are refusing to accept any responsibility. It's clear this should be a shared responsibility.
Where we do see the problem is with the international calls, because that's where the high dollar calls go. And so that's where we're seeing the fraud go to, and I would assume that as soon as we get more competition in the international arena, when the prices come down, this may start to control the problem.
But control one problem and another emerges. The new technology on the scene is portable, cellular phones. State-of-the-art communications technology does not appear to have been matched by state-of-the-art security, and the fraudsters are out in force. With their own language of cell phone tricks, roaming, tumbling, cloning authorized phones to get their bills sent to an existing user. So far, the cell phone companies, hundreds of separate ones all across America, have picked up the fraud bills. Eric Hill of the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association in Washington.
We've got a fraud problem in the States, and we've been dealing with cellular fraud for going on to probably 4 or 5 years now. And the losses are incredible. We're looking at $300 to $400 million a year being lost to fraud. Those are estimates that we've heard. The ability for bandits, as we call them here in the States, to commit technical fraud has been something that's been not committed for the most part until about the last 2 years.
What are they doing?
What they're doing is they're opening up the phones and they're manipulating the electronics, the circuitry, the chips inside the phones, and in fact we say that they're chipping up phones and altering the circuitry such that they can program fraudulent electronic serial numbers and fraudulent mobile identification numbers into the phones.
What happens to the billing then?
If the bandit is sophisticated enough to know the mobile identification number or the telephone number of a good cellular customer, then that phone bill will go to the good customer.
This mystique that's built up around the hackers and the phone freakers is kind of a problem, because there is a feeling that it's a prank, that it's kids doing this, and that it's not so serious. The people that say that have never gotten a 50-pound box of phone bill with a bottom-line number that Carl Sagan would be proud of, you know, billions and billions of calls for $1 million. That's enough to sober anybody up to the fact that this is not a game, that this is serious, and that it's a problem in this country that we think is going to make it across to Europe very, very soon.
But over here, British Telecom feels it's on top of things. Dennis Scotts is manager of BT's Detective Resources, based in Milton Keynes.
I'm not prepared to go into actual levels of crime that we suffer, other than to say we do suffer from crime. It is recognised, and we are addressing it in specific ways.
Cellular phone fraud, the cloning of cell phones, all the other technological things that cell phones can be forced to do by crooks, seems to be very much a problem in the United States, and some of the estimates for cellular phone fraud are an enormously high proportion of the total network usage. Is that a problem here?
I'm not prepared to detail exactly the extent of that problem, other than to say that we recognise it and are trying to combat it.
Trying to combat it, but it sounds as though it's perhaps more of a problem than network fraud is.
I'm not saying that. We are combating it with a great deal of success.
But Peter Summers says that British phones and British businesses are pretty vulnerable to international fraud. He's a computer expert who writes under the pen name Hugo Cornwall.
All the technologies that make it possible for a phone free to operate today, and they're mostly operating against companies, not against the public network, those things are being installed, have been installed in the UK. We're a little bit behind, not very much. So how much is going on, I can't really say. Are all the preconditions there? Yes. Is there any reason to suppose it isn't going to happen here? No.
Hugo Cornwall, ending those extracts from the programme In Business, introduced by Peter Day.
And if you're interested in that subject, look out for Hugo Cornwall's book called The Hacker's Handbook. Now, the first edition of that is the best. It's blue and it's no longer available. I think they toned it down in the second edition. But in the first edition, they've got some information about free phoning into someone else's phone. And someone asked me about this at the recent Stockwood Park Radio Rally, the car boot sale. And don't let anyone try and flog you one of these boxes that will purportedly give you free calls, because I think they ironed out this problem largely about 10 years ago. So there's no more free calls via the simple route with the relay that you may have known about a few years ago. Hello to everyone who I met at the Stockwood Park National Amateur Car Boot Sale, as I was talking about. Sorry I didn't get everyone's name. I should have done that and then I could have said hello. Someone I met was one of the engineers from Green Apple Radio in London, an FM pirate who I've heard many times, and he informed me that they've recently been running 125 watts over Christmas and about 25 watts more recently. That 125 I heard very clearly down in Surrey. He also said that apparently Lightning Community Radio, which is a reggae station which have been on very much every weekend, they've recently been raided unfortunately, but they have been using one of Trevor's limiters, apparently, something I'm sure he's not aware of. So now the DTI have one. Lucky old them. Someone else I met at the Stockwood Park car boot sale is Tim Hunkin, who used to draw those strips called The Rudiments of Wisdom in The Observer, and more recently has been known for his automata and clocks, and had the Channel 4 series A Secret Life of Machines. Had a chat with him and got in touch with him, and hopefully when I get the time I'll go over to his base in Suffolk and report to you what happened. Now I've told you, I won't be able to forget to do it or get out of it, so hold me to that one in a few weeks' time, a few months possibly. And now Andy Cadier in Shortwave Magazine has just passed on to us his writings. Radio Facts have continued to make representations to the Home Office, the DTI and the Radio Communications Agency in an effort to obtain a licence to broadcast from the UK. The present service on 3910, 6205 and 12255 is provided from Southern Ireland. Programmes include reports on electronic and scientific subjects, with an emphasis on communications and media news. The programme called Sparks is obviously aimed at radio amateurs and persons in the communications field, who naturally possess the HF receiving equipment with which to hear the broadcasts. Recently imported religious material and a relay of the Radio Caroline satellite service has been added to the varied format. It is suggested that if all those who wrote to the station also contacted their MP, politicians would become aware of the educational aspects and business potential of Radio Facts. There is a distinct possibility of former USSR states selling airtime on high-power HF transmitters to earn badly needed revenue to help subsidise their own broadcasting activities. The UK tends to licensed stations many years after the bubble of enthusiasm and commercial endeavour has burst. Andy Cadian, there's a very dark picture of him huddled over his computer and shortwave radio writing his report. So don't forget, the address to write to with your comments about Sparks or any other programme is Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. I guarantee to read your letter out on air if you address it to Sparks, and to read a bit of it out. And if you'd like a reply in writing, which includes the station card and information sheets and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence or 3 international reply coupons or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And I'll just pass on a fax that's come through to us from Euronet Radio Sales. Urgent, this isn't an offer of broadcast satellite airtime. This is not a circular. Please read carefully. Attention, General Manager. Dear Sir, Euronet Satellite Radio. Euronet is a new satellite and cable distributed radio service which has been formed to offer various special interest and ethnic groups the opportunity of having their programmes broadcast into the homes of over 36 million people across Europe. We would welcome the opportunity of carrying your organisation's programmes over our Euronet service when we commence regular transmissions later this summer. Our primary language is English, although we do intend to also carry programming in other languages as the need arises. We would be most happy to accommodate the needs and requirements of your organisation in the field of reaching audiences in Europe, blah, 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 blah. Our test transmissions commence Thursday the 14th of May via the Astra 1B satellite transponder 20 Sky Sports, subcarrier 7.56 MHz, audio 6 on an Amstrad receiver. You are cordially invited to join our project as a regular broadcaster. Well, their phone number, if you've got megabucks to spend, is 071-613-1101. Or fax them at 071-386-9381. Give the phone number again, 071-613-1101. That's from Andrew R. Yates. And a rumour about the Astra satellites is that MTV have mysteriously recently changed transponder from one on Astra 1A to one on Astra 1B. And it's quite possible that this is because there is now no backup transponder on for the transponders that MTV was under on the Astra 1A, so they've negotiated to move to 1B. No official messages on that, as you might imagine, but that's a bit of gossip I received recently. And something intriguing on the subject of B Sky B in a moment.
From the BBC, further evidence of the reduction in research and design effort as they come under increasing cost constraints. Design and equipment department is being reduced in numbers by some 40% and will cease to exist as such. Three parts of the present department will be retained, but they will be reorganised and will operate from separate sites. The Development Department, which is the group that's been responsible for such things as RDS, and of course the General Excellent Technical Standards set by the BBC ahead of most of the rest of the world's broadcasters, they will be a smaller group and they'll be co-located with the Research Department at Kingswood Warren in Surrey, with the majority of staff housed in a new building. The development function will be separate to research, but services such as wiring, mechanical workshops and the drawing office will be merged with those existing in research department for greater efficiency and to reduce costs. Development will consist of three sections, retaining the present expertise in radio frequency, digital audio and video, and software development work. The move of development department will actually take place when the new building has been completed at Kingswood, and there's also to be changes for the supply and support services and the corporate purchasing departments. So changes there at BBC. And in the Financial Times, B Sky B near liquidation last year. British Sky Broadcasting, the satellite television venture, came close to liquidation last year. Mr. Frank Barlow, chairman of the consortium, said the trouble came less than 5 months after the merger of British Satellite Broadcasting and Sky Television, when Barclays Bank turned down an application for a £200 million project loan. Mr. Barlow is also Group Managing Director of Pearson, which owns the Financial Times and has a significant stake in B Sky B. Technically, we, B Sky B, were insolvent. If we went on trading without further financing, we would have been trading while insolvent, and I could have gone to jail, Mr. Barlow has said. Mr. Barlow immediately flew to Tucson, Arizona, where Mr. Rupert Murdoch, chief executive of the News Corporation, was staying at a health farm. News Corp has a 50% stake in B Sky B. Mr. Barlow said that over dinner he explained that unless Mr. Murdoch could invest £100 million, he would seek the protection of the courts, and that would have led to liquidation with vast debts. Rupert was very sympathetic, although obviously he thought I was trying to pull some plot to reduce his stake. The £200 million was raised, with Mr. Murdoch putting up part of his £100 million in value. Mr. Barlow forecast that by the middle of 1993, the venture would make profits after finance charges. That was by Raymond Snoddy.
Well, I wonder if Mr. Murdoch got that money off the Mirror Group pensioners. Oh. I'm sure they'd much rather have had their pensions than B Sky B to watch. This week on Sparks, how the Channel 5 TV bidders plan to cooperate, not bid against each other. Phone freaks hack American cell phones. The recent shortwave fade out. And a look at solar storms in general around the time of the recent solar eclipse last year. A review of the Sinclair Zike, the problems of CB abuse, electronic tags for sheep and sports cars, how B Sky B nearly went bust, the professor turning engineering courses upside down, and a crop circle competition. So, in Electronics Weekly, Professor Bernard Cohen and the National Economic Development Council have published a report which turns the way electronics is taught upside down. Carl Schneider reports. Professor Cohen wants to turn electronics upside down. More accurately, he wants to upend the way electronics and other information technology-related disciplines are taught at universities and polytechnics. Cohen believes students should start at the top, learning about systems right from the beginning, rather than spending the first year buried under a ton of basic physics and maths. In electronics, that means learning about digital systems and circuit design before diving into the basic physics of semiconductors. In all subjects, you forget most of the basic stuff after university, Cohen points out. The physics disappears at the end, so why not start with the discrete models? For example, you don't need to know about basic physics to learn IC design. Of course, a competent IC designer will need to understand the basic physics, but you don't have to teach it first. Cohen believes the methodology can be applied to all technology courses. According to Cohen, the result would be graduates with a more fundamental understanding of their subjects, and also more able to work across disciplines, for example, combining hardware and software engineering. It also makes it much more interesting for the students, he comments. This is where the NEDC comes in. The council has run a number of studies on ways to improve the output of high-tech graduates. One of the problems it faces is that technology courses have a much higher dropout rate than other subject areas. Part of the reason may be that students find it difficult and not very interesting in the first year, suggested Barbara Stevens, head of the NEDC's Electronic Applications Sector Group. She believes that pushing some of the basic maths and physics into the later part of technology courses will make them easier to tackle in the first year, and because they're more interesting, students will be more motivated to tackle the difficult parts. In the longer term, Stevens hopes that top-down technology courses will help boost the number of applications for places. People's reasons for choosing courses are usually based on rumour, she explained. Technology courses have a reputation in schools of being very demanding. The accepted wisdom is that if you want to have fun at university, you should do an arts course. Whether you want a job at the end of it, though, is another matter. I've personally found that accepted wisdom myself. Anyway, back to the article. This will change, says Stevens, if teachers bring the excitement of systems-level teaching into schools. The first student teacher that goes into a school after taking a course like this will start to bring about change, she enthuses. According to Cohen, some UK colleges, notably Hatfield and Southbank Polytechnics, and the universities at Strathclyde, Brunel and Surrey, have taken some steps towards top-down teaching in some of their courses, as well as his own city university. Well, that's something to think about if you're in the sixth form at the moment, or thinking of becoming a mature student.
Now some publicity on Radio Netherlands for a regular weekend operator.
Now a mysterious reception. Between 2050 and 2100 UTC, I heard a transmission of a very professional-sounding radio station on 3945 kHz. I think the name was Radio Trans International. The broadcast was combined in English and Spanish language and included music and commercials. Is there anybody who can help solve this mystery?
Well, thank you, Marcel. As far as 3945 kHz is concerned, well, I did some listening at the weekend, so did about four callers to our answer line. We conclude that you've been listening to a hobby pirate radio station based in Kent in the southeast of England. The station WNKR uses 3945 kHz in the European evening hours, usually at weekends, and on Sunday mornings also pops up on 6400 kHz. The station hires out its transmitter to other people who want to get on the airwaves, and that's what you heard. Contributor Julius Hermans reports that the station announces an address in Wuppertal in Germany, but the transmission certainly doesn't come from there.
Jonathan Marks there on Media Network.
And I've become a regular listener to the 3945 service. I think it's probably the only one I regularly listen to rather than just tune around for, because I find the actual music content very good. And presentation may not be best in the world, but it's the music that matters, really. So something to listen out for all Saturday night, 3945 WNKR. And you're currently listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. Monday and Tuesday is the days for our scientific, technical and media news programme. The Northampton Radio Club's holding a radio, electronics and computer car boot sale on Sunday the 7th of June, starting at 9:30. That's at the Red Lion, which is presumably a pub, you'll be pleased to hear, 400 yards east on the A45 off Junction 16 of the M1. Now, private stands are £6.50 in advance or £9 on the day, and bookings and inquiries are to Mr. P. Young at 0372 41267. That's 0372 41267 for Northampton's local car boot sale event. Off junction 16 of the M1, you then go down east off the A45, 400 yards, and you hit the Red Lion, hopefully not literally, and you find a car boot sale on the Sunday, the 7th of June.
What's Sir Clive's new Zike like? A first ride test report. Sir Clive Sinclair will never live down the C5. The man who invented the pocket calculator, pioneered the digital watch and the home computer will always be remembered for a failed electric trike that made the Reliant Robin look like a supercar. But now, with a bit of luck and a following wind, memories of the ill-fated C5 could start to fade. And the reason? Zike, the zero emissions bicycle. According to the brochure, the Zike is the greatest invention since the bicycle. This is obviously designed to capitalize on growing green concern. But since no one has ever produced a bicycle that actually produces any exhaust gases, it sounds like a particularly obvious bit of bandwagon jumping. Still, that aside, what is the Zike like? Remember those old adverts with athletic nuns jumping off trains to unfold tiny Bickerton collapsible bikes before continuing their journeys to the convent? Well, the Zike is like a Bickerton with batteries. It has a small electric motor driving the back wheel and special batteries built into its frame. Plug it into the mains for an hour and the Zike will power you along at a handsome 12 miles per hour. A three-position throttle varies the power and thus the amount of pedaling you need to do to keep going. This extends the range of the Zike from 1 to 3 hours with a bit of leg work. A regenerative braking system means the batteries are charged up when the Zike freewheels or when the rider applies a bit of pedal power. It all sounds great in theory, but in practice there is a problem. As a rider's machine, the Zike can't cut it with other two-wheelers. The minute wheels, coupled with a high riding position and a hugely long handlebar tube, make it feel pretty unstable. Push the go button, and accompanied by a buzzing sound like a food processor, the Zike slowly moves off. You won't even beat a milk float at the lights unless you pedal extremely hard. On the move, potholes should be avoided at all cost. The tiny wheels just get swallowed. I would also advise against cornering at speed, because the Zike won't happily lean into bends like a big-wheeled bike. To its credit, though, it's extremely light, and production versions will fold up Bickerton style so they can be carried. At £499, it's not cheap, but you don't need a driving license, road tax, or insurance. And even if the Zike doesn't take off, it may still be worth investing in. C5s are now collector's items, fetching up to £2,000. If the Zike folds up and joins the Sinclair Hall of Shame, it too could be worth a small fortune. As one Sinclair employee confided, people are already ordering them in case they go down. And that was Nick Berg's test ride report on the Zike, published in Auto Express, who also write up a better balanced boost. The booster bike is a far more attractive proposition for cyclists with a quest for power. Designed by two boffins working out of a converted stables near Bath, it is a power pack which can be added to any normal bicycle. Bob Shaw and Henry Collier of Engineered Products and Design have stuck to straightforward engineering principles to produce a rugged and reliable system. We looked at all the high-tech options but wanted to go for reliability, says Shaw. A special motor drive fixes to the front wheel of any normal bike, and power comes from two small lead-acid batteries mounted on a rear pannier. It all adds around 16 kilos to the weight of the bike, but once on the move, you hardly notice it. The booster makes no difference to the comfort and stability of the bike it is fitted to. Power delivery is smooth thanks to a special soft start system that prevents the motor jerking into life. And the battery is guaranteed to last at least 20 miles of normal riding. Unlike the Zike, there is only one power setting, but as the booster is designed only to assist cycling, more complicated switches are unnecessary. Recharging takes around 3 hours and costs 3 pence. The whole package costs £295 and can be fitted by a competent DIY mechanic. And they give the phone number for this company producing the booster bike kit, and it's 0225 891912.
I'll just do that phone number again. 0225 891912 for details on the booster bike. And the Zike number is 0933 279 300. If you've got £499 burning a hole in your pocket. I saw a C5 the other day around my way. Hadn't seen one, don't think, ever on the roads. Until then. Now, Andrew Priest has a letter. Here's the latest FM news from the Glasgow area. New legal special event station is Mayfest FM on 101.8 for 4 weeks, from the 27th of April until the 27th of May for the arts festival, the Mayfest. It's done by Glasgow Radio Productions, and I think it's using the facilities of the former East End Radio. Like EER, it was on Chaos FM's 103.5. Mayfest has been allocated a Paisley Pirates frequency. Gnome FM were on 101.7 in March, but not anymore. On the 24th of April, I heard Chaos FM back on what they were calling The Network on 101 FM. Later, PWR took over on the same frequency. Gnome FM were also mentioned as being part of The Network. The next weekend, the same two were back on 101, thus avoiding Mayfest on 101.8. However, on the 1st of May, just below Chaos and PWR on The Network, was another PWR. Fast Breeder, maybe. And also on the 1st of May was another station just below those two, but this was unidentified. All three had fairly weak signals in the west end of Glasgow. On the 24th of April, Chaos mentioned there was a station in the north of Glasgow going to start up, so maybe this is it. You could call into the Chaos on CB Channel 6, but they were announcing their old phone number, 0505 812024. And re-airport information radio in Inverness, there's something similar, but not intentionally. It's British Rail's radio electronic token block system. In Inverness, the controller only can be heard on 105.05 MHz, and in places including Dingwall, Arknakshin, Tain, and in George Mass, both the drivers and controller can be heard on the broadcast FM band. The system is used in place of conventional signalling to regulate train movements on the lines from Inverness to Kyle of Lochalsh, Wick and Thurso. This involves speech and data transmissions which display the places the driver can drive in between on an in-cab display. The use of radio saves several hundred miles of cabling for conventional signalling, thus making the rural lines more viable. It also means one person can control the lines rather than several, as used with traditional semaphore signals and signal boxes. The West Highlands, Central Wales and East Suffolk lines also use RFTB, but I think they use band 3 frequencies. That's an interesting bit of information. Thanks, Andrew Priest, writing from Inverness, one of our regular contributors. And if you've got any similar information, either technological news stories or what's been going on the bands in your area, then please drop us a line and you can become a regular contributor to Sparks.
Great hoax from little circles grow. Rupert Sheldrake introduces the first corn circle competition, which carries a £3,000 prize. The number and complexity of flattened patterns in crops has increased dramatically over the past decade, and it has become more difficult to ignore them. They are discussed in every town and village in the land. Last year, 800 were recorded in England, the world leader in crop circles, and they are now spreading around the globe. The most intense debate concerns the hoax theory. While everyone recognises that some crop circles are the work of hoaxers, can all of them be explained as hoaxers? It is in this context that the first international crop circle making competition, sponsored by the German science magazine PM and the Koestler Foundation in association with Environment Guardian, is announced. The explosive evolution of crop circles dates back to 1980, when three circular areas of swirled flattened plants were first noticed in an oat field in Wiltshire. From 1980 to 1987, about 300 circles were recorded. In 1988, there were at least 112. In 1989, 305. And in 1990, 1,000. By the late 80s, some formations had evolved a long way from the basic circle. There were concentric rings and satellite circles. Rectangular, triangular, and wavy shapes began to appear in 1990 as elements of pictograms, insectograms, and other complex patterns. The forms evolved further in 1991, and the season ended with an amazing fractal pattern, the Mandelbrot set, in a field near Cambridge. Finally, there was the much-publicised claim in Today newspaper by two artists in their 60s, Doug Bower and Dave Chorley, that they had been hoaxing crop formations for years. They gave a demonstration of their rather modest skills to journalists. Those of a sceptical cast of mind tend to be credulous when it comes to the claims of hoaxers, and many jumped to the conclusion that Doug and Dave had explained the whole phenomenon. Even if we believe their claim to have made up to 30 circles a year, this leaves 95% unaccounted for. Doug and Dave are mystified themselves. So who are the other hoaxers? Thinking through the hoax hypothesis to its logical conclusion leads into treacherous territory of conspiracy theory. Organised groups of hoaxers are still out there, highly skilled and sworn to secrecy. Who are they and what motivates them? Are they in the military or intelligence services? Occult groups, performance artists, or secret societies? The Japanese? Other theories are equally speculative. Are crop formations caused by whirlwinds? Mysterious powers of the collective unconscious? Higher intelligences? Some people have firm favourites among the various theories. Others, like myself, are floating voters, and fashions change fast. The trouble is that no one knows just what hoaxers can and can't do. The crop circle making competition should enable us to form a more informed opinion. The conditions of this contest are demanding, but realistic. The formations are to be made at night in a certain place to a set design, incorporating features from previous formations. They will be judged the next morning by a panel of five qualified judges. The first prize is £3,000, but before receiving it, the winners will be asked to make the formation again in daylight and in the presence of observers. Well, that was written by Rupert Sheldrake, who's a biologist and author of The Rebirth of Nature. And if you're interested in participating in the crop circle making competition, then the details are available from the following address if you send a stamped addressed envelope. Guardian Crop Circle Competition, 119 Farringdon Road, London, EC1R3ER. Good luck.
The Philips DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
The Brighton Festival has had a special event radio station for the past few years. This year's effort got some coverage on the Radio 4 Kaleidoscope programme.
This is the third year the festival has had its own radio station, but it's the first year that a PUCO Radio Authority licence has been granted rather than a special events one from the Home Office. Co-director Dan Nathan is clearly after a year-round licence for the station, which concentrates on dance music but does feature other material, like the arts programme Source.
The coverage that we give is not flippant, but not is never over-reverent. The strapline for the programme in the press has been, no cow is so sacred that it wouldn't make a good burger. Well, I'll add that both the producer and presenter are vegetarians.
So
we get firebombed.
So who actually gets burgered? To fit in with the saints and sinners theme of the whole festival, Festival Radio has a daily feature involving alternative hagiography.
Saint of the day.
St. Rose was born in Lima in the late 16th century. When she was 5 years old, her brother plastered her hair with mud one day. She sulked, and he warned her that her hair would get a frizzling in hellfire if she was so vain. So, to her parents' grief and horror, she shaved her head, and this was the shape of things to come. At festivals, when she had to wear wreaths and garlands, she bound thorns into them. Her mother made her sleep with gloves on to make her hands soft, so she stuffed the gloves with nettles, thus making her hands blotchy and swollen. When she had a cold and had mustard plaster stuck to her skin, she kept them on until the skin fell off. On one occasion, she was told how graceful her fingers were, so she went home and rubbed them with quicklime until they were so raw that she couldn't use them for a month. Rose even felt that a comfortable bed was a threat to her immortal soul, so she pulled the stuffing out of her pillows and replaced it with wood chips and splinters. Her favourite item of headwear was a crown of 99 thorns. And get this, she was mystically married to the infant Jesus. Quite a scoop.
Sauce.
28 days there off Festival Radio. 100.4, Brighton. Two items here from the press. First, in the Sunday Times, about Channel 5. Because of the channel's high start-up costs, estimated to be at least £200 million, and the low initial advertising demand anticipated, the players are reluctant to bid against each other for the franchise. That would only increase the financial risks involved in a project which many already fear will inevitably run into big losses. Officials at the Independent Television Commission believe all the parties interested will talk to each other. They suggest a grand alliance of all the bidders could walk away with the franchise for as little as £1,000. The Commission is reluctant to see a rerun of the fiasco over B Sky B, which is 50% owned by News International, publisher of the Sunday Times, and is anxious to award the franchise to a consortium that has pockets deep enough to bear both the start-up costs and the early losses. Once the bids are tabled, the Commission will make a decision on the franchise by November. Channel 5 is scheduled to go on the air in 1994. British Telecom is prepared to create a new national service organisation to take on the huge task of retuning more than 3 million video recorders, which operate on the same frequency the new channel will use. BT's business unit would make its services available to any winner of the Channel 5 franchise and would be established as an operating unit separate from the existing National Engineering Force. That was Matthew Lynn and Jonathan Miller writing in the Sunday Times. And The Independent published a letter from the manager of the longwave station Atlantic 252. The BBC's threat to commercial radio, it's headed. From Mr. Travis Baxter. Dear Sir, Maggie Brown's article on the options for BBC Radio 1 provided an interesting insight into the difficult decisions facing the BBC in its run-up to the charter renewal in 1996. Some of the issues raised are key to the future of UK commercial radio. Longwave Radio Atlantic 252 is the first national-type commercial radio station to broadcast 24 hours a day across the UK. When we launched the station 2.5 years ago, we knew that a narrow programme policy aimed at 15 to 34-year-olds who enjoy a certain type of music would enable us to develop a substantial audience. According to the BBC's research, this formula has been entirely successful, and Longwave Radio Atlantic 252 is now the largest commercial radio station in the UK with more than 5 million listeners a week. One of the most dangerous prospects for the future of national-type commercial radio broadcasting would be a narrowcast BBC Radio 1 selling airtime. Given the huge resources and brand image of the BBC, the new national commercial radio stations would have little, if any, chance of success. Alternatively, imagine the BBC funded in part by a licence fee, but augmented by commercial airtime sales. The consequences of free cross-promotion, i.e. advertising the radio services on television and in the BBC publications, must create conditions that require examination by the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. Add to this the deep pockets that would always give the BBC victory in a price war. Such a formula would give UK national commercial radio no future. I am a great supporter of the BBC and hope that the current review enables the corporation to clarify its role for the next 20 years. But to change a funding formula that has produced 5 successful radio networks, highly successful local radio stations, as well as the terrestrial television channels, without careful consideration of the consequences, could cripple certain industries, particularly commercial radio, and give the listener less, not more, choice. Yours sincerely, Travis Baxter, Station Manager, Longwave Radio Atlantic 252, Trim, County Meath, in Ireland. Published in The Independent.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. A few months ago, a Horizon programme highlighted the recent solar eclipse over Hawaii and the scientists studying it. Here's part of that programme.
The last important telescope to observe the eclipse event is the radio telescope owned by California's Institute of Technology, Caltech. The moon is large enough to block radio waves coming from the sun itself, so Caltech and its British neighbour, the Maxwell, can take this best ever chance to see the layers above the surface in radio wavelengths. Okay. Unlike the Maxwell, the Caltech needs a lot more preparation. Hal Zirin.
This telescope was really not built for looking at the sun. It was built for looking at stars in formation and clouds of gas around stars. It's so darn sensitive that if we pointed it directly at the sun, it would burn up the secondary mirror. So we've had to be very, very careful with what we do.
Zirin's plan is to direct the Caltech telescope at the thin layer called the chromosphere above the surface of the sun. Once they've got the filter to fit,
it can perform a unique experiment for us because the wavelength that it's sensitive to is the wavelength of the thin layer above the surface of the sun where the temperature changes from the 6,000 degrees of the surface to the 1,000,000 degrees of the corona. Actually, it goes down for a little bit and then it goes up. And we don't understand this phenomenon, which happens in so many stars, and there it is in front of us, and nobody's been able to explain it, because you can't heat a 1,000,000 degree thing out of a 6,000 degree thing. It's crazy.
Only in a full eclipse can the Caltech team measure what happens in the thin layers where the temperature rises so sharply. This extreme temperature gradient is thought to be a product of the sun's magnetic field. One theory suggests that little explosions, small flares, spark continuously in the sun's active regions to pour out the energy to heat the corona. This could be the mechanism that Zirin is looking for. The heat produced near the sun's surface spreads through the corona and drives it into space. Charged particles stream out to form the solar wind. The Earth is continuously bathed in these particles. The solar wind compresses and distorts the upper atmosphere and may even have long-term effects on our climate. This effect seems to vary with changes in the sun's cycles, the appearance and disappearance of sunspots. These cycles generally last 22 years. The sun has just passed a period of maximum sunspot activity, the solar max. But there are occasionally much longer solar minimums. The Little Ice Age in the 17th century was recorded by contemporary artists. It lasted 70 years, during which the astronomical records show that sunspots had virtually disappeared. It's now suggested that their reappearance coincides with warmer weather.
The connection between the sun and climate is unproven. The Little Ice Age is an example. That is a field of fertile research at present, but I think it's fair to say that there have been no accepted physical connections proposed for weather, climate, and sun relation.
At the Maxwell, they've got rid of their spurious signals and are already rehearsing for the eclipse by scanning the telescope across the edge of the moon.
So that's the moon?
This is really exciting because we've been going through a full dress rehearsal, and towards the end we've discovered here a very bright region above the sun, a very bright cloud of gas held maybe 100,000 kilometers above the surface of the sun. It's probably a prominence, which is exactly what we're looking for. Having found that, we plan now to produce maps to scan through this region and produce maps of the prominence itself. This is the day before the eclipse. As far as I'm concerned, we can go home now. We've found exactly what I would like to see.
Okay, now...
This first little blip looked unpromising, but the increasing size of the feature on the trace convinced them it was a prominence.
At a slightly different place, you see this very much stronger signal, and then running through it again, sun again, back into the sky, here it is strong again, and stronger still, and it keeps repeating. It's a very strong signal, and it's obviously something real.
Within 2 hours, they've mapped the prominence. The eclipse itself. The Maxwell display shows the moon's shadow far advanced.
Uh-huh. Okay, you can see the top of the peak here is just beginning to be chopped off because the moon is now beginning to poke into this region of the sun. So now we're sitting on the edge of the moon and you're scanning across the sun to the sky and back again. And the top peak is actually going to start dropping right down as the moon literally blocks off the sun.
Oh, it's a huge prominence.
Yeah.
Do we want the prominence?
You'll get it.
Oh, hey, it's great. We got prominences the size of a Buick.
It's slightly bigger than a Buick. It could swallow the Earth 40 times.
Okay, this is the first of the prominence scans. So it's sitting on the moon here, across the prominence, which is actually saturated, it's so bright. And then this shoulder, a really bright region, still way up here. Now we can really see the top of this thing. It's way above the bright feature that we saw. The structure way out at maybe 120,000 kilometers above the surface. It's very, very big.
Okay, finished.
Even my goddamn movie camera worked. I can't believe it.
Amazing.
Okay, go on. Put the solar screen. Take the telescope out.
Le voilà.
Out, voilà. Everything.
Voilà.
Finish. Solar eclipse is finished on Mauna Kea.
The work on the optical telescopes finishes as the corona disappears, so those teams can celebrate. At the Maxwell, they work on with the emerging sun.
So we're just scanning backwards and forwards through a very thin crescent, which is getting larger. There's plenty of time for champagne, I think, when we know we've got it all in the can.
They're preparing for a press conference down below.
The experiment worked beautifully, and that we found that the sun in the millimeter waves was bigger than we thought it was. Thought it was going to be. It's some inches bigger.
We have a limb extension.
It's another way of putting it. We have a limb extension of about 4 arc seconds, which is about 3,000 kilometers. So that the millimeter wave sun is about 3,000 kilometers bigger than the visible sun. I don't suppose that's much of a big deal, but it's very exciting to us.
Caltech's results confirmed the Maxwell's data.
It is 1.3 millimeter radiation. This is what the Maxwell telescope is designed to see. At the point that the visible sun has totally disappeared, there's really quite a bit of 1.3 millimeter radiation still visible. It takes it about 7 or 8 seconds for that radiation to totally disappear. So that's a measure of how much of this chromospheric material is still sticking up above the edge of the moon.
He can see the actual density of the invisible layer of the chromosphere. The lumpiness is real, showing a turbulence far greater than they expected. This could provide a clue to the mechanism of the temperature rise in the corona.
Horizon, having a look at recent research into the sun. And of course it was a solar flare that caused the recent shortwave fade out on the 10th of May. More about that later in the programme.